national pain that we are in. We are looking for solutions to all kinds of crises, but this is also an excruciating moment. The losses and the inability to even say goodbye, the ways that we have seen how little Black lives seem to matter to so many. And so part of what we do is we come together to do the work that we can, because as my father always said, the struggle continues. And so our job is simply to stay in the struggle, and we'll stay in that struggle with Color of Change. Thanks for having us.
We are out of time. I would like to thank all of the panelists, and we want to thank Color of Change for granting us permission to share this audio with you. I would also like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. If you would like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. This is your host.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Also on the web at kboo.fm. Next up is Fight the Empire.
Good morning. Today's March 4th, the day Donald Trump is supposed to make a triumphal return to the White House. Apparently, Congress is not in session. Democrats left town yesterday evening, and as far as I know, there's no sign of Donald Trump anywhere. Maybe he's if anybody knows where Donald Trump is, give us a call at 503-231-8187. When I heard news accounts recently of Russia interfering in American politics, my first thought was, well, this is what nation states do to each other. And that suspicion was confirmed in a recent article by Max Blumenthal on his website, The Gray Zone. According to the article, the United Kingdom Foreign and Commonwealth Office has tasked the Reuters press agency and the BBC to push regime change in Russia and undermine its central government. They work through a shadowy government outfit known as the Consortium, which is not to be confused with Consortium News, a highly truthful media group of the same name. The article states, Reuters and BBC solicited multi-million dollar contracts to advance the British state's interventionist aims, promising to cultivate Russian journalists through FCO-funded tours and training sessions, establish influence networks in and around Russia, and promote pro-NATO narratives in Russian-speaking regions. In several proposals to the British Foreign Office, Reuters boasted a global influence network of 15,000 journalists and staff, including 400 inside Russia. Well, this sure seems like interference and meddling to me. It's an old story, actually, Reuters and the BBC. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, they worked on secretly funded projects to undermine the Soviet Union. And the work continues now that Russia is no longer Soviet. If anything, Russia is more of a target than the old communist superpower ever was. and President Vladimir Putin is more reviled than dictator Joseph Stalin. Here's my theory why. Back in the 1990s, Russian President Boris Yeltsin allowed Western money men to buy up public property on the cheap. The Russians who sold the properties made billions and became the oligarchs. Perhaps the most famous is Mikhail Khodorkovsky. A good account of this period is the article "The Harvard Boys Do Russia," and you can read that in the Nation magazine of May 14, 1998. Here's part of this, the first paragraph of that article. After 7 years of economic, quote, reform, financed by billions of dollars in U.S. and other Western aid, subsidized loans, and rescheduled debt, the majority of Russian people find themselves worse off economically. The privatization drive that was supposed to reap the fruits of the free market instead helped to create a system of tycoon capitalism run for the benefit of a corrupt political oligarchy that has appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars of Western aid and plundered Russia's wealth. That is from the Harvard Boys Do Russia in the Nation magazine of May 14th, 1998. I recommend that if anyone who wants to get a good idea of what is the basis of what is happening in Russia today. It's like this drive to kind of subvert the Russian economy has never really let up. It just continues in different ways. When Putin took power in the year 2000, the looting largely ended, or it took a different turn. As far as I can tell, the oligarchs were allowed to keep their wealth, but now they had to pay their taxes. Some of them chose to live in London, like the oligarch Boris Berezovsky. Others learned to live with Putin, and the West never forgave Putin for putting a stop to the looting. The Gray Zone article goes into great detail and provides supporting documents. It puts into perspective the narrative of Russian meddling in our politics. One can imagine the furor if Russian money men had gone whole hog, as it were, and descended on a prostrate American economy and carried off the pieces. You can imagine what would happen if, Russian oligarchs were to buy up shares of the American economy and take away the profits. It would make the so-called meddling that we talk about seem rather superficial, which it is. This is something that nations do to each other. If anybody wants to call in with a comment, the number is 503-231-8187. If you have something to say or want to talk about these topics, give us a call now. Better to call now than wait till near the end of the show when we may not have time to really go into it very much. So once again, the number is 503-231-8187. A lot of the so-called the meddling that sort of it came up in connection with the 2016 election, in which Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton, and right away the Clinton team came up with this explanation as to why she lost. Actually, she didn't lose a popular vote. She got more votes than Trump did, but Trump got the crucial votes in the Electoral College, which put him in the White House. So it's not so much the Russian meddling that put Trump in the White House. It is this archaic political system that we have, the Electoral College, in which small states with low populations wield power out of proportion to their small populations. And they can kind of, in a way, they can outvote larger states with more people. And this system, we still have it, and it has several times in the recent past put a president in the White House who actually got fewer votes than his or her opponent. And that's what happened in 2016. So Hillary Clinton, in a way, she won the popular vote, but she lost in this archaic electoral college system that we have. And so rather than call into question the system itself, the Clinton team kind of focused on Russian meddling, or what they consider Russian meddling, which it seems to me is what pretty much the normal state of what nations do. When we comment all the time, our media and government officials and TV voices comment all the time on events going on in Russia, which is our right to do, you know, but it's not considered meddling, it's considered fair comment. And so when the Russians do it to us, it would seem to me this is the way the game is played. So if anyone has a comment on that, do you think Russia interfered in our election? Number to call is 503-231-8187. One thing that I've been talking about now and then on this show is the idea of a public bank. We do have, there's one state in the United States, North Dakota, has had a public bank, a state bank, I believe since 1919. That's over 100 years. And one thing a public bank can do is float bond measures to pay for various projects. You know, we all know how every election, it seems, we are given some kind of a bond measure to vote yes or no on, you know, for funding schools or public works projects or whatever. And these are generally very good things that need to be funded. But the way it works is this, that we vote, say we pass a $5 million public works measure, and what happens is that the some commercial banks will put up that money to pay for the actual work, and then the voters, we pay those banks back plus interest. So if you vote for a $5 million bond measure, I'm not sure how much of that money goes to the banks in interest, which is sort of pure, this is the way banks make their money, this is where their profit comes from. And depending on what the interest rate is, it could be, I've heard, and if people want to correct me, give us a call, but I've heard that up to half the amount actually goes to the banks in the form of interest. If anybody has the opinion on that, give us a call, 503-231-8187. This is a wasteful way of running a government. But a public bank, if you had a public bank, this presumably would not happen. The bank would put up the money, and then when we pay the bank back, the interest from a public bank goes back into the public treasury. So the money stays with the people. It doesn't go to bankers on Wall Street. It stays right here. So right now there is a bill in the House. I guess there are two bills, one in the Oregon House and one in the Senate. And in partnership with the Oregon Public Bank Alliance, this one measure has been introduced by Representative Con Pham. And the bill establishes a legal framework for Oregon cities to create public banks by themselves or in partnership with other municipalities. Right now, Oregon cities and other municipalities pay millions of dollars in interest and fees to Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, and other big banks. That money ends up lining the pockets of big bank CEOs and shareholders rather than getting reinvested in our communities. With public banks, all the money is kept local and profits are reinvested in the community. And the example that this article gives is the Bank of North Dakota gives the state millions of dollars of profits, which are then used to invest in the state's needs. So too would a Bank of Portland or a Bank of Medford reinvest its profits into the community. And this municipal bank bill updates banking laws to give Oregon cities a clear path to form a public bank if they so choose, enabling them to, fund infrastructure, affordable housing, and other public benefit projects at lower interest rates and fees than conventional Wall Street financiers. And also invest the bank's profits locally and partner with community banks and credit unions to increase their lending capacity, particularly to historically underfunded Black, Indigenous, and people of color owned businesses. So you can support the municipal banks in Oregon by calling your state representative or state senator. The House bill is HB 2743, and so you can make it for a more equitable system of public financing, and as a taxpayer, save yourself some money, make your dollars go a little bit further than they would otherwise by having a municipal public bank. If anybody has a call or wants to call in to make a comment, do it now before the show nears end, because that sometimes a good discussion gets cut short because of time constraints. So the number to call is 503-231-8187. I really want to recommend this article in the Nation magazine, The Harvard Boys Do Russia. And it goes into great detail on how these money people came in to took over the Russian economy and made off with the bank, with the profits. And this happened under Boris Yeltsin when he was president of Russia. He took over around the year 1990, and he was in power for a good decade. It was not until the year 2000, I believe, when Putin took power. And you can read this in the Nation magazine. And so when Putin took over in 2000, he put an end to the looting, or took a different turn. As far as I can tell, the oligarchs who had already arisen in the previous decade, they were allowed to keep their wealth but now they had to pay their taxes. And some of them chose to leave Russia, like Boris Berezovsky, and others learned to live with Putin. They learned to pay their taxes to the Russian government, to the Russian people, as it were. And so you basically sort of have two groups of oligarchs. You have the Western crew that lives in the West and have nothing to do with Putin, and you have the oligarchs in Russia who are still allowed to make a lot of money, but they do have to share the spoils to some extent with the Russian people. And the Gray Zone article goes into when Putin put an end to this. I think what happened is that the West never forgave him, because they had a good deal going, and along comes Putin, really out of nowhere, put an end to this this wholesale looting of the Russian economy. How he was Putin, as everybody knows, he had been in the KGB stationed in Germany, where he learned to speak fluent German and learned a lot of other things about the West. And after that, he went to work for a Russian politician in St. Petersburg, his hometown. I believe the gentleman's name was Sobchak, and he was considered a reformer. And near the end of the Boris Yeltsin decade, Putin was kind of selected. He was an unknown quantity to kind of replace Boris Yeltsin. And my guess is that they expected him to continue the policies of Yeltsin. But lo and behold, this unknown quantity came up with his own plans, and so it sort of threw a monkey wrench into the Western plans.
We have Roger on the line.
We have somebody on the line. Roger's on the line. Good morning, Roger.
Hi, Pierre. Always like to hear you talking about Russia. I don't know if you remember, the Moon of Alabama wrote an article about how the Internet Research Agency was kind of a for-profit deal. I think he was a sausage maker guy. And they were, the minuscule amount of stuff they put on Facebook and stuff, it was, you know, they spent maybe a few $100,000 compared to the Cambridge Analytica, which was heavily financed to the tune of many millions of dollars by Mercers, Rebecca and her father, Robert Mercer. And it was a for-profit operation, too. I mean, Cambridge Analytica would, you know, they were like micro-targeters for hire to African elections and Mexican elections and Ted Cruz. And then when Ted Cruz lost, they went to the Trump campaign. And but it's pretty much financed by the Mercers, who went on to finance Parler. So I think the Russian involvement was minuscule and probably almost certainly not a state thing. And I also don't believe, as I've heard you talk about, that there was anything about the Russians giving WikiLeaks the emails and stuff. Anyway, I love listening to you, and I'll get off the phone and listen on the air.
Well,
I have one more comment, though. What do you think about shutting down Congress just by putting out the word on the Internet that, oh, maybe you're going to, like, go in there and get through 5,000 National Guard troops and razor wire and breach the Capitol today, and so they shut it down?
Well, I was wondering about that. I've been trying to catch up on the news. far as I know, Trump has not appeared anywhere, but Washington seems to largely shut down. Congress has closed up, and I think all the congressional Democrats, they left town yesterday. So it's like, but here, I'm waiting to find any latest news on what's going on. It seems like a very weird situation, and Trump, as far as I know, is nowhere to be seen. Perhaps he's lurking around in Mar-a-Lago someplace. But yes, this is a if anybody has any latest news on what's happening in Washington now, I think they should give us a call, 503-231-8187. Do we still have Roger on the line? I guess not. What? But anyway, no. Hello?
You know, he's off.
Oh, he's okay. Roger's finished his call. But one thing that strikes me is that this Russian interference, which is kind of normal between nation states, this is what they do all the time. As far as I can tell, their interference budget is rather small compared to some of these other outfits like this Cambridge Analytica. And so at least one thing you say is that if the Russian project has been that successful, you might say is that they seem to have a way of getting the most out of their money. They spend a small amount and get a huge result from it, if you can believe the what our media and public voices are saying. But like I said, I think this is when you actually look at it, if some Russian media enterprise comments on U.S. politics, well, isn't that normal commentary? Or what is the dividing line between normal commentary and observations of what's going on in another country and actually interfering? You can say the U.S. has been interfering in other nations' politics for a long, long time, certainly ever since the CIA was created after World War II, and probably even before that. The U.S. has got a long history of kind of getting into other nations and running them to suit our economic interests. So if anybody would like to give us a call, we have about 4 minutes left in this show, not much time, 503-231-8187. So there's this dividing line between interference and normal commentary is really very fine, and it seems to get the line gets crossed all the time in just a normal political kind of the way the game is played. And so when Putin does it, it seems to be a cause for alarm, but when we do it, it's just sort of the normal standard operating procedure. So this has been Fight the Empire. We are here on your radio station, KBOO. It belongs to you, our members, the people who fund this station. You know, KBOO is really part of an enormous step forward in radio broadcasting, where people like you and me and just anybody.
We have Marcus on the line.
Pardon me?
We have Marcus.
Marcus is on the line. Got a few minutes left. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning. Yeah, the demonization and blaming of Russia has a long history that very much precedes even the time period you're talking about in the 90s. If you go back to World War II, which is America's pretty much our favorite war that we like to celebrate and glorify and romanticize, most Americans would be completely surprised if you explain to them that most of the fighting happened on the Western Front, that it was the Russians that really fought the war and did most of the dying.
Mm-hmm.
America lost something like 400,000 people, approximately, in World War II, and Russia lost something like 26 million. And you'd think that that would be something that we would know, but we don't know that. Most of our movies celebrate the idea that we won the war, that we were the guys that got the bacon out of the fire. The demonization of Russia for geopolitical events all over the world was very useful in terms of describing American foreign policy in Central America in the 80s and in the Reagan-Bush years. Everything's blamed on Russia, whether it was the Sandinistas in Nicaragua or the rebels in El Salvador. This was a boogeyman that could somehow justify American foreign policy aggression and blame Russia as being the real bad guy, that whatever country we were operating was just a surrogate country, and that the big bad Russians were the real evil ones. And the last thing I'll mention is you're talking about Yeltsin. Yeltsin was particularly catastrophic for the Russian people. People were starving to death. People were freezing to death in Yeltsin's years.
That is true. Well, I hear our music playing, so
okay.
I wish you called it up a little bit sooner. We could talk about this a little bit more, but our music is playing. This episode of Fight the Empire is over, and stay tuned to KBOO. You're